Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The number of measles cases in Michigan continues climbing, with 41 cases confirmed. That's led to doctors and public health officials grappling with just how best to deal with a public health crisis that is spreading across the country. A middle school in Birmingham ordered unvaccinated kids to stay home after a student was confirmed to have measles. In Brooklyn, New York, people who refuse to get themselves or their children vaccinated could face fines. Rockland County, New York, issued an emergency order banning unvaccinated children from public spaces. So are these effective methods to protect public health and change the minds of parents who choose to not vaccinate their children? Here to talk about that is Mark Navin. He's an associate professor at Oakland University, where he teaches bioethics and he researches vaccine refusal. Mark, we know that even though a large majority of Americans do have their children vaccinated, CDC numbers show the number of unvaccinated kids is rising. Why?
Well, I think one of the first things to think about is how many different reasons these parents have and how many different communities that they're coming from. So one mistake I think we can make when thinking about vaccine refusal is relying on our sort of gut stereotypes, right? And I think there is a sort of popular stereotype of a certain kind of overeducated white suburban mother who trusts her own intuitions and nature and is skeptical about mainstream medicine and the government. And while that might sometimes be accurate, one way to challenge that is to think about some of the recent outbreaks, right? So Manhattan and Oakland County, these are communities of Orthodox Jews. Minnesota a few years ago had an outbreak in a community of immigrant Somali Muslims. Pennsylvania's had outbreaks among the Amish. And so I think one way to start thinking about vaccine refusal and understanding where it comes from is understanding it comes from a lot of different places, a lot of different values, a lot of different kinds of beliefs. And so, for example, we know in Oakland County, many of these folks are not committed vaccine refusers. The problem is largely a sort of lack of good integration with public health.
When and where and why, Mark, did vaccine opposition really take root in the United States?
Well, I mean, this is a sort of question about history, and in history, line drawing gets hard. We know that there's been vaccine refusal from the beginning of the history of vaccination. So in England, it starts very soon after you get vaccines, and it gets organized once the first vaccine mandates start in mid-19th century, and with a similar mobilization in the United States, with multiple organizations of citizens, often calling themselves things like the Anti-Vaccination League.
So this is not new, but certainly there seems to be a greater awareness, and we're seeing an acceleration in the number of parents who choose to not have their children vaccinated. What does that stem from?
Well, so, I mean, it's worth sort of saying outright that the overall rates of vaccination are at or near historical highs. And so we're actually in a period of great success in public health efforts. And so it's important not to panic and be proportional. It's frightening, right, that we had a disease, measles, that was eradicated in the United States. It's back. But in some ways, where we are now is more the norm than the kind of decades we had where we were maybe excessively optimistic about getting rid of it. As for why its sort of concerns come back, I would say a lot of the concerns are the concerns people have always had. You know, on the one hand, this is an intervention you do on healthy children that it's hard for some people to wrap their heads around. On the other hand, when you don't see the disease, it's hard to be motivated about prevention. And then I think on other hands, there are deep sort of political divides in this country. While people in public health and in medicine are really committed to sort of solidarity and public projects, I think just looking at the state of politics in Michigan, if not our country, shows that we really disagree with each other about what kind of resources and efforts we should be expected to deploy towards things like fixing the roads, right? Mm-hmm. And we also disagree about the rights of children. You know, we're having debates about gun ownership, right, and guns in the home, and or even things like swimming pools and driving SUVs, and about how these put both our own kids and other people's kids at risks. We have a sort of ongoing and evolving debate about where we draw these lines in our decisions about how to live together.
I'm speaking with Mark Navin, who's an associate professor of philosophy at Oakland University, where he teaches bioethics and social and political philosophy. I want to talk about the response on the part of public health officials to this growing outbreak of measles. We mentioned a few of them at the top, with fines and banning unvaccinated children from schools and public places. Are these effective in your view?
So maybe I should just start by saying I'm very pro-vaccine, but I tend to be, in my written work, critical of a lot of the ways in which we sort of respond to or think about responding to vaccine refusal. And one criticism I have is we sometimes rely on an oversimplistic way of thinking about these responses. And so you asked, are they effective? And I think there are at least four different questions worth keeping separate, because there may be different answers to each of them. And so we might ask, are they legal? right? Mm-hmm. Are they ethical or just? Are they legitimate? And are they sort of wise or prudent?
And I think the bottom line is, do they result in more children getting vaccinated?
Well, yeah. So this is a question about wisdom or prudence. And the easy answer is yes. In the short term, they certainly do. We know this in California. You know, non-medical exemptions, once you take them away, more people are going to get vaccinated because they don't want their kids kicked out of school. We don't know what the long term is going to be. But even if in the long term it helps with keeping kids vaccinated, there might be other social costs that make it unwise to ramp up coercion, even when it's effective at decreasing refusal and increasing immunization. So, you know, we want our kids to stay in school. We want parents to be able to stay in the workforce, which means having daycare. We want people to trust public health and their government. We don't want immunization policy or public health policy more generally to become any more polarized than it needs to be. These are all other good things that we want to do. And so we have to balance these sorts of good things we want against also wanting to increase immunization rates as high as we can get them.
So what would be a more effective approach from the public health establishment?
Well, I mean, I think one question to say is we know some things don't work. So effective hides a lot of different things. So if what you want to be effective at is changing minds, shaming, stigmatizing, criminalizing people doesn't change minds. Rather, relationship building, communication, patience, and trust, these things change minds. And in particular, when these relationships occur across sort of existing affinities, right? So the people who are able to change my minds are people with whom I agree with about most everything else, which really tells in favor of public health being well integrated into the various communities they serve. But if you mean changing behavior, well, yeah, coercion works, but it has lots of costs. And so, as I said before, I would want to balance the effectiveness of getting behaviors to change against some of the other costs you end up paying when you ramp up the coercion.
You talk about someone you have a relationship with that you respect, which leads me to ask you about parents and the pediatrician. So let's say I'm a pediatrician. I have a parent who comes in with the child and refuses the recommended schedule of vaccines. So what should I do or say, and what should I not do or say?
This is a hard question. So, and maybe thinking first about the American Academy of Pediatrics and their evolution on this issue is helpful. In 2005 and then reaffirmed in 2012, the American Academy of Pediatrics said that pediatricians should not dismiss these families from practice, but should keep them and should continue the relationship and continue educating and counseling and building trust on the hope that some parents would change their minds. In 2016, they said dismissing these families was an acceptable option, given the sort of burden on clinicians and some worries about risks to other patients. So I'm sympathetic with the sort of struggles among pediatricians facing these problems. I think it's best for kids, and I think it's best for the community, and frankly, I think it's best to fairness among pediatricians for them to keep vaccine-refusing families in their practices. One worry, right, of course, is if these people are dismissed, they end up clustering in the few practices that take them and increasing the risk of outbreaks. In fact, we've had one measles outbreak in California that originated in the waiting room of an office of a pediatrician who accepted vaccine-refusing patients.
I think you and I know, as we talk, there are parents hearing this who want to scream to the vaccine-hesitant parents, you choosing to not vaccinate your child puts my baby, my child, at risk. We get feelings like that, and they could lead to vitriol and anger and everyone shutting down. How do we change that into constructive vaccine communication?
I mean, one way that I try and manage, because I share those emotions, and that's where I begin. It's how I started this, having young kids and realizing some of my acquaintances weren't vaccinating. I didn't change my mind about the importance of vaccination, but I was able to sort of tamper some of the anger by thinking that, you know, we disagree with each other about a lot of ways in which it's reasonable or not to place other people's kids at risk. Someone who puts a pool in my neighborhood, even if they put a fence around it, just put my kids at risk. Someone who drives an SUV, right, puts my kids at risk since we drive a smaller car. Heck, the city planners in my city who don't have physical barriers between the bike lanes and the roads have put my kids at risk when they ride in the bike lanes. And so I think thinking this is a political question about how we balance various interests in society together, a question of which I think vaccine refusers are on the wrong side, but nonetheless an ongoing debate and discussion among reasonable people, I think that helps me think about and sort of manage my emotions about this better.
And to the parents who say, it is my right to not have my child vaccinated, where do we meet?
Well, it depends on what they're claiming, right? So if they're claiming that in Michigan right now you have a legal right to refuse, well, certainly you do. And even in Brooklyn, some people have called this compulsory vaccination, but still you have a right to refuse. You just have to pay a fee, right? So the degree to which it's criminalized is still kind of moderate. Right? There's a way to buy your way out of it. But I think it's a difference between what the legal rights are and what we think they ought to be, and what we think moral rights are. And so I think, no, sometimes people talk about their children as if they're their property, or talk about their rights over their children as if you can do whatever you want to your kids so long as you don't kill them. I think that's wrong, but members of this society disagree with me. And so in some ways, this is a debate about democracy. In a democracy, we don't always get what's just, right? We don't always get the best answer. But we try to get what's legitimate, which is to say what sort of represents the will of the people. But sometimes my fellow citizens disagree with me, and so the will of the people that's expressed is not, it's going to be suboptimal from a sort of point of view of rights or what's good.
Mark, is there I'm going to use air quotes here, is there a solution to this dispute, to this debate?
I mean, I suppose it depends on what you say the problem is. If you're narrowly scoping this to immunization rates are low, then sure, ramp up the coercion, bring the state power down, you'll get those rates up. But if the problem is lack of trust in government, or lack of social solidarity, lack of willingness to do your part to keep up our institutions. I mean, I really think there's a deep analogy with our roads, right? A lot of the previous generations in the state built up great infrastructure. It falls to us to keep it going. A lot of us seem unwilling to keep it going. We inherited herd immunity, community protection with high immunization rates. It falls to us to keep it up. But I think we sort of lack a sense of social solidarity. So if, depending on how you scope the problem, whether or not there's a solution that's easy at hand is either going to be well, obviously true or difficult to find.
You've really given us a lot to think about. This has been really interesting talking to you, Mark Navin, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Oakland University, where he's done extensive research on vaccine refusal and the public health response to it. Mark, we want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia. It's a great conversation.